Live from Paralandra, this is Derailed Trains of Thought. All right, Tim, this is awesome.
Well, I'm having trouble keeping my balance, but this is a really... I've never been in an ocean like this.
No, this is... It's just beautiful, and there's that fruit on the tree.
That
and
we're fruit just, is delicious.
I know, it really...
You only need one of them
and
to
yeah,
fill
you
up.
Yeah, you don't really feel like anything else.
It's amazing.
This is one of the best places we've ever been. It's like paradise.
Agreed. And there's not even anyone around.
No, it's just us.
Just us.
At least for now.
Yeah.
Knowing our luck, we won't just stay that way. But still... So, yes, this is a fun locale.
You should be jealous, everyone who's listening.
Yes. You, too, want to come to Paralandra.
And you can if the price... Well, actually, no, you can't.
No, unfortunately, no.
But it's a nice little summer getaway, and we're, strangely enough, at the end of summer already. I don't know how that happened.
And, yeah, and according to my kids, it's now school year, and so it doesn't even feel like summer in the same way.
Yeah. That's just sad.
Yeah, it is sad. They should come to Paralandra with us.
Either that, or we should take them to the Tri-State area where they apparently have 104 days
of summer.
I know.
That's what I did. Yeah, they would like that. I think they would enjoy the Tri-State area.
I think they would. So. Might be a little hazardous to their health, but...
Well, everything works out in the end.
So it's true.
So, anyways, guys, I'm Nick.
And I'm Tim.
We never introduce ourselves, but we thought maybe if we have new listeners, you would like to know who we are.
And hopefully you are new, and hopefully you do like to know that.
Although we've already ruined them. They're like, I wanted to go into a podcast, make sure they don't introduce themselves. We failed.
Oh, well, so, sorry.
Anyways, let's go ahead and jump into Story School. Okay, everyone, today's Story School, I guess the best way to describe it is that we're going to try to talk about stories that move you outside of yourself, transcend the medium and the themes you're going for.
Yeah, because art often tries to, you know, kind of bring us outside of ourselves, not just give us the same old, but just bring out something in us that's... we can't really access on our own sometimes.
And the best art tends to really, you know, it suddenly can lift you up into a, you know, a different levels of knowledge or even touch you spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to kind of discuss sort of that continuum.
Yeah.
Starting from sort of like, hey, that's cool. That's doing something new. And that's more of an intellectual realization in many ways.
When talking about this, I think we'll probably, yeah, we'll move past the intellectual, because obviously there's a lot of like seeing something that you haven't seen done that way for the first time.
Yeah. So we'll start with that sort of cool, which is more intellectual, to more the wonder, awe. Mm-hmm. And then what we call kind of, you know, transcendent art or transcendental moments in your book, your movie.
Or whatever.
Well, whatever. So let's start at the basic layer. This, it's cool. Do you see how cool that was? That was the coolest thing ever. You know, you see, I mean, certain people say that about every movie they've ever seen. They're like, man, Autobots fought for like 20 minutes. That was so cool. But, you know, that sort of thing, though, is a real thing. That's, you know, kind of the gut level why we read and watch things.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that is a little easier. We've talked about this. Well, there'll be some overlap with this topic with our beauty episode from a whole 2 years ago, which is kind of amazing. Actually. But when you're small, you get these moments like a lot more frequency than you do as an adult.
There's a quote Ravi Zacharias talks about. I think he stole it from Chesterton or added to Chesterton. Talk about when you're, you know, telling the story to your 12-year-old and you're talking about he opened the door, he walked and he opened the door and there was a dragon outside and that's, oh. And then like to your 5-year-old, he walked and opened the door and like, oh. And then like to the 2-year, like, and he walked, oh. You know, that sort of level that it becomes, nice. The older you get, the harder it is to, and I'm stealing this straight from Ravi Zacharias, the harder it is to make you feel wonder.
Yeah. An example of this, I remember, I think I've mentioned on here before, having very distinct memories of going to the theater to seeing Beauty and the Beast. Because I went like right age where like it's not just kind of you're vaguely paying attention or you've seen it before. It's like it's all new, it's all fresh. And I remember specifically like the moment where it looks like Beast has died and just feeling this very overwhelming sense of sadness, and then this kind of overwhelming sense of joy when he came back. And you've seen these near death things in scores of kids' movies, especially Disney. Even like Tangled, you know, it has kind of this, yeah. A protagonist is dying, and as an adult, it can't affect you the same way. You know, it's going to come. Something's going to turn out right.
So I guess the first thing we learn is that as a creator, you can only hope for the best on this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think you can manufacture, you can to a certain extent. You know, there'll be like, I used to watch a lot of like, me and my brother, like martial arts films. Like, you know, you can see certain movies trying to do the coolest action, you know, martial arts scene ever.
Yeah.
And you get like, oh, that was, I'd never seen, oh, it was Matrix. Uh-huh. You know, so you can manufacture it to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And it is largely like just one-upping what's come before in many ways.
That's true. Or if you're creating something very new, or even in some ways just trying really hard, you know, because we're in a world that often settles for mediocrity.
Yeah, that's true.
Especially like, say, in, you know, children's movies. And I think that's one reason why Pixar has just thrived so well. I remember moments in like, say, Toy Story 2 or in The Incredibles where I was like, how can this be this good?
Yeah.
Like, movies aren't supposed to be this good.
I'm sure it's that on the podcast at some point, but I remember going to see Ratatouille because it's Pixar and whatever. Uh-huh. I'm like, a movie about a rat cooking should not be as good as this movie is. And every time I watch it, I'm like, what? How does this exist?
Or the Lego movie, even.
The Lego movie was one of the more modern examples. I go in there, oh, that's a Lego movie. I come out, I'm like, that was genius. Yeah. I mean, and it's not breaking ground necessarily, but it does it with such confidence and such skill. It just works.
In a way that almost seems effortless.
Yes. And I guess, like they often say, where it looks like it's, you know, where everything works, like when as a viewer, a reader, it seems effortless. Someone put a lot of time in.
Yeah.
And so just putting your time in and tweaking and, you know, spending the time editing and checking and all that stuff pays off for at least, especially this cool factor.
Definitely. I will throw in one more example of this and then we'll move on. A New Hope. Star Wars. The original Death Star run.
Oh, man.
I
got shivers when I was a kid watching that thing.
I know, right? Like, I remember, like, just thinking about it afterwards and just kind of living it moment by moment. I would get about excited about it as some people get, like, on their favorite play of a basketball game.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's coming down, all this stuff, and you got the timer going, the screen between Tarkin keeps moving up.
And Darth Vader has just been picking off other pilots one by one, and Luke is in his sights next, and then out of nowhere, Han Solo shows up. Euphoria.
Exactly. First time I saw Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it was just sort of one of these, what? You can make this and it works? Uh-huh. You know? So there are those sorts of things.
Yes.
And that's really neat.
Yeah. So kudos to you filmmakers who've been able to do that.
So that's, you know, and I think we can all find, you know, our own, oh, that man, that was such a cool fill in the blank action scene, suspense scene, Mission Impossible, the heist, you know, fill in the blank. And then I'll kind of ramp it up one more. Is that sort of that one or that all where it's like you are fully invested in this world and it's just like, what
is this?
And it almost let, you know, you're completely pulled out of yourself in some ways. You know, you're just like, I'm watching something and I'm, you know, it's just, you feel lighter after it. You feel like, you know, your life is better for having watched it.
Thinking about this category, I actually tend to go a little more towards books than the movie medium. And I think that's specifically because one of our favorite authors, C.S. Lewis, there's a couple different Narnia books that I feel like really capture this really well.
Dawn Treader.
Yeah, Dawn Treader is definitely one of them. The Last Battle, I think, is in The Last Battle, that picture that he gives of heaven is just...
is wonderful.
Yes, it's glorious. It's everything. It's still, for my money, one of the best depictions of heaven in any medium.
Movie-wise, I have to give credit to Miyazaki. Just his... you watch those movies, you just like... you feel like the world's like 10,000 times better than it really is. I mean, you know, there's just this this airiness about some of his movies that just like, this transcends, you know, not quite transcends, but you know, this is wonderful in the wonder sort of way.
it captures that kind of feeling we've talked about sometimes where art shows us not the world as it is, but how as it should be. And yeah, Miyazaki does that remarkably well.
And, you know, and he has great music to go along with it.
Yeah, thanks to Joe Hayashi. Castle in the Sky is one of my favorite examples of this. And Castle in the Sky kind of gets overlooked sometimes by some of the more recent Miyazaki stuff, which I totally get. But Castle in the Sky kind of hits me like both like old me who just loved the good adventure stories and kids in dangerous situations. But it also appeals to new fantasy loving me in a sense of a guy, you've got this kind of mythic ancient force that has been lost or city that has been lost. And the music just kind of goes really well with that too.
It's for, you know, since you mentioned books and favorite authors, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. I knew we'd have to mention that somewhere
just,
in here.
You just can't because, okay, so the movies capture the world in some ways or the action, but the book captures such the atmosphere, the feelings, the deep hurts and longings are just, it's just a beautiful, it's where, you know, we probably talked about back in the Beauty episode, I don't remember, but not just beautiful in the language, or the language is beautiful, but the people are beautiful, you know, not the simplicity, but the
honorableness
the honesty of all the characters. You know, everyone's motives are, they're simple motives. I mean, not in the sense like everyone's good or everyone's bad, but they don't have all the extra things that real life has.
It's not concerned with like, it's not a story that's concerned with the underpinnings of what's under, as if everyone's got their own agendas.
Yeah,
sort
exactly.
Of thing. So the hobbits and the wizards have different goals in mind and they have different wants and needs, but it's not as if there's subterfuge except from the, like, we're going to send our king off to face Sauron while we really are confiding in this ridiculous hope.
But that sort of honest, like, just good childhood sort of subterfuge, you know?
Yeah. It's a battle subterfuge. Yeah,
not much gray.
No.
You know, when Sam is Sam and Frodo is Frodo and Saruman, everyone is themselves and they're not like wrestling, you know, like a lot of modern stuff and even some of my stuff, you know, wrestling with who they are. They are who they are, but they're wrestling with how do I do this?
And you say there's not a lot of gray, which is true, but at the same time, the struggles the characters deal with also feel very real.
Yeah.
Like, Frodo doesn't get off being the ring bearer very easily.
No.
He carries that trauma with him for a long time.
I think when you get to this level, you've moved beyond, like, oh, you please the kind of my pleasure sensor, you know, like in action or in, you know, you read some book and you read, like, mystery books, you know, it's cool because all the twist.
It all comes together.
But by the time you move to the second level, this awe and wonder, you've moved to this, it's ringing with something true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you watch Miyazaki, like, even if you don't believe the world's that way, you wish it is. Or you believe the world really is that way once everything, you know, like from a Christian point of view, once it stops being fallen.
Mm-hmm.
That it's starting to resonate with some sort of like hidden self, that all the distractions of the world kind of.
Uh-huh. Now, it'll be interesting to see. I'm curious how, the more we talk about this, how you compare this stage, the wonder stage, to the more transcendent, because we've already kind of tied into
it. Again, and it's a continuum. I think there's no set. I made it up. But, okay, one more thing. I'm in the middle of a book called Man Alive.
Okay, which I am due to read soon.
we have this book club that we...
So there will probably be even more overlap in the things we talk about.
Imagine that. no, but what G.K. Chesterton, one of his, and even Orthodoxy, though it's nonfiction, has some of this kind of all wonder about it.
Hmm.
Because it just, he's so good at getting you back in touch with just simple joys.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me, I guess, is what wonder is attached to more than just like pretty eye candy. Now, sometimes you go to... You see some movie and it has just these vistas. Oh, one more on this one. That I was thinking is, I don't think everyone felt this way, but when I watched John Carter, the movie, I'd remember that if you could suspend your disbelief, it was just this entire world that I felt like I had not sat in a movie that gave me an entire movie world for a long, long time.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know if I'll feel that way next time I watch it, but I remember it was just sort of this refreshing, like, as I took it, just it was this.
You've been to
like,
another planet.
It's like watching Star Wars again, a little bit. I mean, I'm not trying to say they're the same level of movie, but it was the first movie in a long time that tried to
try to be somewhere else,
something completely else. Yeah,
nice.
I felt. And again, I think it was such a, I think there was a high jump of disbelief for a lot of people that they couldn't
right, they make couldn't, it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember having, maybe not in the sense of wonder about it, but I do remember feeling that like I am in a foreign place. And then yeah. when you left the theater, you had suddenly returned to yeah. Earth somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So let's try this third level.
Okay.
Okay. So this is the transcendent level. Like you're actually, I have one example that's more of a, you can tell they're trying to and it's not working. Uh-huh. But you know, where it's, I think really hitting spiritual things.
And I feel like this is, go back to what you say, they were trying something. Sometimes I think this happens without the storytellers even realizing that it's going to happen.
I think almost it has to a certain extent. I feel like you can't, at this level, you can't manufacture it.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm sure there's ways to do it more just by the topic you're covering.
Sure.
I mean, an action movie is not likely to have one of these things. yeah. I mean, it could, but it's much less likely than a more serious, dramatic sort of mm-hmm. deal.
Okay, right, so give me your example of...
Not quite working?
Of not quite working.
Have you ever seen Cloud Atlas?
No.
Okay. Interesting movie. And you could tell they're trying to have this deep meaning of all these six layers. And it is a fascinating movie from a technical point of view.
Okay.
But from the, like, you know, trying to cut it together and have this sort of deep meaning of... of progress and helping people and stuff, it didn't work for me. Partly because it rang false to me, because uh-huh. I didn't necessarily agree with all
sure.
their theme. Then I suppose for people who agree with them all, it might get closer,
right? And when we've covered some of that before too. Sometimes when something doesn't ring true with you, because of difference of worldviews,
I think transcendental and for having said it has to ring
yeah.
very true.
Yeah. The funny thing is, I think that if you're touching on a universal truth that most people can find common ground on, it's interesting how you can kind of, even if the filmmaker, storyteller is not coming at it from the direction that you would, somehow they're coming one way, you come to another way at it, and you sort of meet in the middle, and I can have sort of a transcendental experience.
Yeah.
The example I'm thinking of with this is actually Les Mis. Or Les
Mis is on my list here.
Yeah.
Too.
Funny thing, the first time I ever saw Les Mis performed, I'd seen like one of the movies, not the Russell Crowe, the
older movies.
Yeah, one of the older movies. I think the one with Liam Neeson.
Okay, yeah.
So I was familiar with the story, but the first time I had seen the musical of it was actually at East Noble High School.
Oh yeah, with yes, they did it all out.
Yes, and if you don't think a high school can do Les Mis justice, you don't know East Noble
or Mr. Monk.
I know one of our. One of our faithful listeners was obsessed with Les Mis in high school. You know who you are. but when I saw this version of it, I completely understood. And I don't know that the musical creators, Victor Hugo is yeah. another matter, but I don't know the musical creators were necessarily very Christian.
Yeah.
But I found the Christianity oh, yeah. very strong in it.
Mm-hmm.
The song I remember listening to the most afterwards, because like I checked out a Broadway recording of it from the library for a while. I actually listened to the finale quite a bit.
Oh, the finale is so... When I watched the newer movie, it about killed me, that finale.
Well, see, and that's interesting, though, because for me, the movie didn't have the same impact as it had somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, the musical movie, it almost felt like they were going with this very humanist sort of, yeah. like, someday when we have... when we humankind is ready to work together, yeah. we will bring yeah, ourselves forward in a new thing. Whereas from my perspective, I'm thinking more of when tomorrow comes, talking yeah. about the future, about yeah. the hereafter.
Yeah. When I have the soundtrack now and yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Yeah. And it is a beautiful kind of triumphant rendering of that. And I don't know which way it's possible the movie version is more accurate to what the musical creators had in mind.
I do know Victor Hugo, when I read Les Mis, because Les Mis, the book itself also, I think, it's close to this in some sections.
Uh-huh.
But Victor Hugo is interesting because on one hand, there's a lot of this very deep Christian theology. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of this brotherhood of mankind will progress to utopia.
Uh-huh.
So it's a weird mix of the two. So
yeah,
that's why you get the movie, you know, so they're actually relatively close to Hugo.
Interesting.
In both versions.
In both interpretations.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
But Les Mis is on my list for both book and movie. Like, and I think it's just because transcendental images almost give you that ache.
Mm.
Like it almost hurts. It's so
beautiful.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Or so true. Or so maybe you can't even explain it. It just hurts you to watch. It good hurt. It hurts so good.
yeah.
you know, like Some Wonderful Life does that for me, but I mentioned that before, we won't talk about it, but just the goodness of these characters, you know, mm-hmm. like, it's not like good, like, oh, you're a good person, but like an archetypal sort of good, like Jean Valjean at the end of the book is just, uh-huh. I don't know if I've read a character that exudes this sort of just goodness in the same way he does.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that ache, that recognition of something so good is, you know, a form of homesickness in
yeah.
a sense. As Lewis liked to say, you know, this world is not where we're supposed to be. So obviously we have some longing for a future place. That means yeah. that's where we belong.
Well, I mean, this whole discussion is very much, you know, kind of runs parallel to his discussion of joy.
Hmm, yeah.
That, you know, joy is almost the desire for something you can't get yet. I mean, that what's so joyful for us is just even the wanting of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it can come in weird spots. You know, just read, you know, you look at, you know, for him, he saw this what little garden thing and
uh-huh.
felt it, or read a part of a couple lines from a Norse poem. And so it can come in weird spots.
Okay, this seems like a good time for perhaps my weirdest example yeah. of a transcendental moment. Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, I can. I don't know what part you're talking about, but I can completely see.
Well, now it's a funny thing, but you know, I've watched that movie for years and years since I was a kid. But I remember one particular Christmas. This was, man, I don't know. I was well after college.
Yeah.
And one particular song, it's in the Singing in the Street Corner Choir. Oh, yeah. It's going home, and it's true. Wherever you find love, it feels like Christmas. I remember one particular time watching that song, and I mean, love is a theme that permeates that whole movie.
Yeah,
and I remember one particular one, just thinking, just kind of tying it in with the true meaning of Christmas, about God sending His Son, about God even being willing to enter the world for our yeah. sakes, and all this stuff, and. You know, love is a very tricky thing to do, to talk about in stories without it coming across as cheesy.
Yeah.
But in that one particular moment, I remember just feeling overwhelmed with a sense of God's love because of that song
yeah.
in that movie. So
yeah.
it's fascinating how, yeah, God can show up in anywhere and anytime. And one of my books in grad school and in college, actually, but I read it like an expanded version later on, was Real Spirituality. Real spelling, R-E-E-L,
okay,
is that
okay,
like
yeah.
real film. And that one talks a bit about, one of the chapters really goes into this, people who go to movies looking for a spiritual experience.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to go to a certain type of movie to, like, certain more artsy movies
yeah.
tend to be easier.
I've never seen Tree of Life. I'm sure we've talked about that here before, but a lot of people have that.
We've talked about how we haven't seen it?
Yeah.
Quite possibly. But yeah, that sort of thing. There's a certain category of that. I remember one that I watched in film school was The Green Mile, which doesn't get into like necessarily the joyful side of like what we've been talking about,
yeah.
Which is something else we should touch on. You know, sometimes this transcendental feeling isn't just this like happy ache. I think
yeah.
I think sometimes it can appeal to, you know, a darker side, a perseverance through trials sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, most of my other examples are things I've talked about in various forms before. Like this Easter, we watched with the youth again, Passion of the Christ. And that, I don't know, I always wonder how a non-Christian watches that movie. But it cannot be the same way I watch the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's possible to disconnect myself from it in a logical way. At least last time I watched it.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that's a very painful one.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you remember. I think this year around Good Friday, I shared a post on Facebook about being in a Easter musical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in that, I was playing the Apostle John, and I was with Mary at the foot of the cross. And of course, you know, beginning of the scene, you're kind of going through the motions. Yeah. I mean, obviously, you're acting the best of your ability, so of course you're sad, but at some point, like during every performance, the fake tears would always dissolve into real, honest to goodness,
yeah.
real tears and actual sobbing, like on stage in front of hundreds of people who don't know that you're really crying. I mean, everyone's in the moment. It's
yeah.
it's a bizarre, bizarre experience
yeah.
where I was kind of alone at the foot of the cross with Jesus in front of hundreds of people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, there's definitely something to recreation of stories like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I'll throw in Bradbury real quick here, because like Summer and I, she loves Bradbury too. I got her hooked on some of them. But like there's this story in Dandelion Wine called The Happiness Machine. This might not be transcendental necessarily, but just it's
maybe it's the wonder part of it.
It's right in between, I think, just because Bradbury at his best is, well, and he's often about his best. He can make you ache. He can make you feel. Mm. And the Happy Machine just, you know, it's about this guy's trying to build this Happy Machine, and it's like, it's really his family. And it just, you know, one of these things that probably should be cheese, but it just comes off as like, just like, if only could, all of Dandelion Wine just makes you, at least made me just hurt with want, with nostalgia. Mm. It is a weird feeling to like hurt because you have this nostalgic sense of something you never actually lived, mm-hmm. but it just, he's very, very good at that.
Yeah.
And that's probably more right between, not quite spiritual, but it's what attracts people to him because he has a sense. And I think that, you know, great writers do this sense of the things that really matter or mm-hmm. need to get in the stories.
Yeah. Sometimes an emotional idea is an important element of the story as the, you know, the plotter or what have you. I've been reading a book by Ed Catmull, the president of Pixar, called Creativity Inc. lately. Fabulous book. I'm sure I'll have more anecdotes to share from it in the future. But he talked about their pitching process, and they go through a very elaborate kind of hammering out the stories of each of their movies, and sometimes throwing out massive chunks or massive ideas about a movie, but they're always encouraging the director to kind of, who's pitching this the story, what's an important idea that you really want in this thing? And that usually that kernel, that very important emotional idea, usually carries through the whole movie.
That's why you get these movies that they hurt. Like, my sister will not watch a Pixar movie anymore because she knows she'll just be a blubbering pile of tears on the floor.
Aw.
You know, so she just won't watch it, Haley.
Yeah, Haley,
she just can't do it, you know, because, you know, I think she watched Toy Story 3 and she was done. She can't handle it anymore.
Oh, man. Did she go to see Finding Dory?
No. She wanted to because she loves Finding Nemo and she's a swimmer and all that, but
yeah, I knew Dory was a very, she loved Dory a lot, so it's like, wow, that's the case.
Yeah, so it just, and I think it pays a lot if you I don't know that you can plan the transcendental, but you can get farther down the continuum just by having an emotional idea that matters.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, I forgot.
This you looking off in the space trying to find your
I'm
thought.
Trying to figure out, there's some Pixar movie where I was just thinking about Pete Doctor, is that his name?
Inside Out?
Oh, probably Inside Out. Yeah, you know, just, well, and he does it for that one and for, he did Wall-E too, right? No, that's the other guy.
No, that's Andrew Stanton.
Anyways, you know, you can just see these things that matter deeply.
Mm-hmm. And it shows, they put in the...
Because all the cool worlds and all the cool characters and all the cool plot twists really don't matter if you don't have that center.
Mm-hmm.
And the deeper you can get to a real thing you care about and that most people care about, the more your story shines.
Transcendentally.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to use fancy $3 words.
Yeah, there you go.
So, anyways.
There's some ideas for, I mean, again, it's hard to plan for transcendental as a writer. Maybe as a viewer, you know, look at some of the movies that have really moved you in this way. And you know, it was funny looking, because I just kind of thumbed through that Real Spirituality book when I was looking through it. And I was reminded, one, of like how the side of academics I tend to get away from, like some of the, like, okay, I obviously we like thinking deep about this stuff, but some people like to go like really hardcore academically stuff in this, and which is totally fine. But I think it's worthwhile to understand what types of stories, what types of movies may help you think outside of yourself.
Yeah.
And don't be ashamed of, I mean, if I can have a deeper appreciation of God's love from a Muppets movie, that's awesome.
Exactly. And I guess remember that is one of the purposes of art.
Yeah.
Is to pull people outside themselves. That's kind of an interesting and challenging thing to do as a creator.
And as a watcher or viewer. As a viewer.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So that is our Story School.
Yay!
So let's go to soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
right, so after all that talk, it's like, what soundtrack do you pick? And then I'm like, damn, like, how perfectly, like, you use that. Okay. So I've been, I'm sure I've mentioned, but I always
Maze
mentioned,
Dude, what?
I know, imagine that. No, not really. I now have an early copy of, no, American Pixel. No, but it got funded. Yay, American Pixels. Good job, Maze Dude.
Congratulations. We helped in a small way.
Very small. Anyways, we were very happy to have you. I remember falling in love with Beethoven's Ninth many, many years ago. I've seen it listened to it various times. I did a whole kind of like a CD that walk you through, like, hey, here's how all the pieces and themes work. And I thought that was awesome. But there's a double fugue near the end of the fourth movement. Now, most people know the theme from the fourth movement. I'm not going to sing it, but, you know, the Ode to Joy. But, and I'm going to play you just this 3-minute clip. But the problem is,
because the full movement is like 22 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Can't do it. It's like a whole TV episode.
Yeah.
But the problem is, this is the end of a lot of stuff. So it doesn't have the same, you know.
Won't have quite the same impact.
No, but it's still at least a very good piece of music. And apparently this is a free copy off archive.org.
Awesome.
Which is cool. So you can go and hunt. I think you download the whole thing. It's kind of for saving cultural purposes. But awesome. So this is Beethoven's Ninth, Fourth Movement, around minute 15 to 18 in this particular recording. People play at different speeds. But it leads into the double fugue and just this sort of angelic sound, I guess. So anyway, I hope you enjoy. And if you've never listened to Beethoven's Ninth, go find a copy. It's only about an hour, 72 minutes to listen to. So enjoy. Welcome back. Sorry to take you back down to earth so quickly after that.
Man, Beethoven, that's going to be a hard act to follow, Nick.
Yeah, so you better pick a really good soundtrack, Brahms or something. Okay, anyways, we're going to follow that up with Project Update. So So I just finished my 10th symphony. No, take that, Beethoven. So how about we start with you, Tim?
Oh, you want to start? Okay.
Why not? I'm the host. I can do that.
Well, yeah, you throw it at me this time. All right. Well, let's see. The last 4 months, I've been working on a video, freelance video project for Restore the Glory, which is a local dance ministry. And they did their performance was like at the end of April. And it's been a very long road to...
A long and winding road.
Yes. But that long project is finally wrapping up. I've sent the bulk of the DVDs in the mail. It took way longer than I meant it to.
Well, you had like 10 camera angles or something like that, didn't you?
Something like that. I mean, it was way too much stuff to be tackling all on my lonesome, which for the most part, up until today, today was the first time I brought other people in. Well, I take that back. Last week, I went to my brother-in-law to help me export the project as I was having computer problems. But then today, I was like, help, I need help mailing all this stuff. And so family came over and they helped me package it all up, which was very kind of them. But yeah, next time I it was a great learning experience. I mean, and beautiful production to be a part of. I felt honored to do it. We're like, really, some great choreography. And the whole performance, the theme was Revelation, which I thought was a really interesting...
The book, not necessarily just...
The Revelation, the book.
Yeah.
Which was very gutsy, but they did it really well. I never would have thought, actually, the Revelation would translate the dance so as well as they did, but because they didn't bother with any interpretations of anything, which was smart and very unifying for a church.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you try to interpret Revelation, you're making someone mad.
Yeah, pretty much. So they just, you know, they just kind of went with, they had someone dressed up as a dragon, they had a Lady Babylon, and they just used the words straight from the text. And in a very abstract sense, it worked beautifully.
It really would. Yeah, when you told me that, I'm like, yeah, that would be pretty cool.
So I'll have to show you some choice examples after we're done here.
Sounds good.
But it was a lot of fun. I learned a lot. I know a lot of things I would do differently next time. But yeah, so I was very happy to be part of that. And the DVD is not for sale. It was just for parents and grandparents who ordered it beforehand.
Okay.
But you'll probably at some point get to see some sort of montage online that if you really, really want to.
Cool. Very cool.
Yep. So that has been my big project for the last 4 months. Although, Nick, I hear you made a breakthrough on one of your long projects.
Yeah, for the last 4 months. I mean, 4 years. I mean, since I was born, I've been working on Sir and Fred Book 3.
Okay. Not since you were born. Last 10 years.
I prophesied since before I was born.
They'd be like, Book 3? What in the world is Sir and Fred?
It took a while to interpret the prophecy, but but yes, I have officially wrapped up the rough draft of Book 3 of Stern and Fred. I know, it's pretty amazing. My two, like someone, one of my five fans said, when can I read it? And I was like, well, the first third of it's basically done. The second third of it needs another good edit, but it's not too bad. Third section is needs at least a whole chapter that I forgot. And I'm sure the end needs tweaking because endings are hard to get the right tone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, regardless, no matter how I do the ending, it's going to be one of those, I think you'll finish the last page and be like, where's book four? Which is why people like Stern and Fred, but also why they hate Stern and Fred. But anyway, it was satisfying. It was actually oddly like mundane to finish it. Like I just finished it and said, hey, I'm done Natasha. And I went and like read or something.
After all that time.
Because I guess,
I'm back, he said.
Exactly. Because it was all the hard work had already been done, you know, in many ways. And it was just sort of like, I was expecting any time now I might finally get to it. And I think also the ending's not quite where I want it yet. And that's some of it too, because it's not like, aha.
Okay.
But normally if I can get over the hump and get to the last chapter, then it is sort of like, okay, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was happy when I finished Squire,
mm-hmm.
but I can't remember whether it was like that last one, like yes, or whether it was just like,
Well, so would you say it was an easier ending than the Squire? Cause I remember you saying that like next to last chapter was really hard on you.
Yes. No, it was not as hard as the Squire ending for a variety of reasons because all the hard stuff happened before that.
Okay.
And also Squire is a single book.
So
there's a lot more making sure you tie up things.
Mm-hmm.
And while I tied up a lot of things in Stern and Fred, there's a lot of things I didn't because I don't need to yet. And
sure.
I want things for the Strofnik book running. So, but yeah, emotionally, it might need some little tweak. I think it was really nice to, I had just started reading Man Alive before I did The End, which gave me, remind me the sense of that sort of older style of writing, which I kind of wanted at the end, not to change the style, but I had a lot of internal, the ending's actually relatively internal for the third part, which is weird, but
interesting.
True. Yeah. It's not a big action scene.
Yeah.
The other two endings are, I mean, the three parts.
So going back to analogy, if you've applied to Strindberg Fred, and I've seen in Strindberg Fred itself, like comparing it to Babylon 5.
Yeah.
I noticed there's some similarity in the structure where your first book was kind of fairly self-contained, like the first season, introduced a lot of your characters. Yep. Second book, much like the second season, you did a lot of emotional pondering.
Yeah.
And it was very setting things up, ramping action, basically. And so does that mean book three is the climax, if you will?
Book three climax is a lot of book two.
Yeah.
There is a lot of payoff.
Not climax. What do they call the act three?
Well, yeah,
three
no,
structure?
That's right. Yeah. That I mean climax okay. and then
falling Newman, action and then Newman. Okay.
Yeah. Because it is very similar.
You know, people can't hear that waving arm thing you do.
I speak with my hands, which doesn't work on radio. But it is a lot. I mean, you're going to do Babylon 5. It is a lot of season three. A lot of, you know, season three of Babylon 5, those who haven't watched it, you need to. But there's a lot of crisis. Like almost every character kind of has this crisis. Hmm. Like where they switch and they'd be like, you know, the doctor has his drug thing.
That's right.
And then like Delenn has her thing with the council. Well, that might be four. I mean,
no, I think it might be.
It might be three.
I forget now.
And they break away from Earth. And, you know, there's all these, everything's.
All these
everything
big
gets
moments.
Broken. Yeah. And there's a lot of that sort of stuff.
Okay.
For the character. I mean, almost without fail, the characters that start book three are not the same characters that end book three.
Interesting.
In many ways. Which is part of the reason it took so long.
The most curious character I'm trying to figure how that would happen would be Gregor. Is that his name? The council member?
He doesn't change a lot. I mean, the main players. Some of the minor characters. Well, there's even some minor players too, but it's... Okay. And then book four will have... would in theory be more focused because Strindberg was written on the cuff, especially book one. There were a lot of moving pieces.
Oh, right.
And I don't want to make a 10 book series. I just want to make a four book series.
Okay.
So there's a lot of things that had to be cut off or ramped down or killed off or, and make not like, oh, we don't want this Alana person. We'll just blow her with dynamite sort of, lost stuff, but you know, things that I think thematically work really well.
Cool.
I don't know what I feel about the book because it's been such a long time and so many parts, but I think it's good-ish.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Usually, right after you finish a rough draft is usually not the time to evaluate.
I've heard a few people have read part one, like our friend Brian Churchill, like loved it. Like he like read it all in like a night or something like that. It's like 60,000 words.
Wow.
So.
And that's an old part by now, too.
It's a very old part, but I think it's probably still something I worry is my best part. But anyways.
All right. Well, people can be looking forward to that.
In the year 2027. No. The revisions go much faster than the writing did.
Good. I would love to get a chance to read it before you send it to publisher.
Well, I want beta readers. So yeah, you'll be
beta testers, beta readers.
Beta readers.
Awesome.
Beta fish.
All right. Well, we've talked about some of our individual things. We should talk real quick because I don't know if we've ever talked about the latest Children of the Wells novel.
Oh, have we not? Really?
I'm not sure if we ever did.
Okay. Well, Children of the Wells website may not be working when you read this.
Yeah. We've been having issues with that for the last month or so.
And I don't understand. But anyways, if you can get there or just go to Amazon.com or other places, The Seekers and the Hidden by Greg Meyer.
Yep. Longtime listener.
It's very good. It was a wait, but it's a nice thick.
Mm-hmm. It's novella. A full length novel, basically.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It is.
Yeah, as opposed to our normal novellas, which I don't know that we'll do again anytime soon. But it was a learning experience, and I think it's a good read.
And it has a lot of good new characters. It expands some of our cities.
Technically, it's Bronicleia number four.
Yep.
So you get to hear about Bronn and Nyasha as they meet. People around Therion, and
you get a lot of the aftermath of Cataclysm. Finally, we've jumped ahead 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yeah, definitely. So it's around the same time frame as Call of the Watchmen, right? ish.
It's after Call the Watchmen.
After Call the Watchmen. Yeah. Okay. Which, I mean, because that itself had like a 2 or 3 month gap.
Yeah.
It's
close. You're right.
But. So go check that out.
And we have more books coming.
Yep.
We're trying to get back into the rhythm of things.
Yeah. And hopefully fix our website.
Yeah.
Our poor website.
Our poor website. Yes. And I'll just throw since we're talking about projects. Always go to worksonic.com. I've been really making an effort to get out all my old stuff this year. So every couple of weeks, you'll get some new story that most people have not read. Unless it's been around for a long time.
Was it not on the website before? Or?
What?
Like, because I've seen you post.
Well, some things are like all the Flash Fictions were, but like okay. I've put a Stuart Lemoir hero on there. A lot of my short stories were not on there unless they were new.
Okay, nice.
So I've been slowly kind of putting them on, and nice. there's some interesting stuff there.
And I appreciated your blog you did today.
Oh, good.
About sleep. I could identify with that.
If my life schedule allows me, I would like to actually blog more often. I mean, I'm starting to get ideas, and I think that would be fun, but Stern Fred comes first, or had always come first.
Absolutely.
So, we'll see.
All right.
So, Tim, what shall we now do?
I think we have one more small segment here.
Which is?
Our take
on Tales. All right, guys. So it's the end of summer, unfortunately.
Strangely.
And we normally do a summer movie recap. We were talking off mic that we have not actually seen that much, right? Myself especially, because with a 7-month-old new baby, it's hard to get babysitters when she doesn't sleep right or doesn't like people. And
And I just found it hard to get excited about a lot of the summer's movies, quite honestly.
But Rogue One, Tim.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
Winter.
Yes.
We're talking about.
Winter. That might be another sidetrack, honestly.
I'm really excited for Rogue One. I don't know. Maybe, you know, it's cool factor. Star Wars trailers are always cool. I think you just have to put that music there and a couple TIE fighters and you're set.
I mean, and that's really cool in theme with their kind of underlaying that both the Imperial March and the Star Wars theme. Like that, that was impressive.
Anyway, start with one of the ones you saw that I haven't.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Well, we'll just go, then I'll get in the middle and.
Okay, so I only had like three and you had one.
I saw Civil War, but I really wanted to. And then nothing else happened. Almost saw Star Trek Beyond, but didn't get out to it.
I was going to say, let's just start with that, because we usually start with superheroes anyway.
Oh, I guess that was one of the earliest ones.
And it was a very early one. So
okay,
we might as well
Civil War.
Okay, remember how you said before that you've often felt like you're the only one who didn't care much for X-Men 2?
Yes.
That's kind of how I felt with Civil War, honestly.
Really?
Like, there are lots of parts in it that I really enjoyed, but I did not feel it was one of the stronger Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But I know I'm in the minority there.
Because it's been a while now, but I remember really enjoying it. I don't think I thought it was, like, the best thing since sliced bread, necessarily. But first of all, the action scenes were just great. I love the action scenes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, the there's no denying the fight scenes were, like, every fight scene was fun to watch.
Yeah. And I'm a sucker for this whole Captain America, Iron Man, their philosophical debate.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. It makes sense to me. And it adds something to what is just normal, which is basically just an action movie with superheroes.
Sure.
So I really enjoy that. And like the end, just with them fighting each other, they basically don't both want to. It just, it's kind of sad. And it was weird. There was kind of a sad movie at the end.
It was. You weren't quite sure. The bad guy sort of seemed to win in some ways.
Yeah, and it was, I think, the problem with analyzing Civil War is in many ways, for me, it was a payoff for a lot of stuff. But by itself, it might not actually be that good of a movie. I mean, not that it's a bad movie, but it...
Right.
I'm not sure it stands by itself at the same level as, say, like, Guardians of the Galaxy or something like that.
Well, see, the problem for me is... Anytime superheroes fight, and I don't mean just like petty squabbling, that's par for the course. But anytime we're like they're getting to a knuckles, smackdown, there's usually, it's hard for it not to be at least a little contrived.
Yeah. No.
Because it usually involves, because, you know, these are both good. They want the best for, if you're going to go into that sort of violence against each other, either someone's being mind controlled or they're not in the right state of mind some way. Or there's some really stupid misunderstanding that they just fly off the handle kind of uncharacteristically.
And luckily, at least they avoid most of those things.
Yeah, and they avoided most of those things. But apparently, from what I've heard, they handled the Civil War way better actually than the actual Civil War comics did. They avoided some of the pitfalls of the comic series had done. But what I didn't care for, the Scovia Accords, I had a lot of questions about.
Oh.
Because, like, one, they're sort of getting on the Avengers for causing property damage, which really the only thing that could really be pointed, okay, maybe S.H.I.E.L.D., but they had no one had known that Hydra was still around. You know, that wasn't really the Avengers' fault.
Yeah.
Sokovia could be pinned on Tony and Bruce.
Yeah.
But just them, honestly. It's like how it should have ended, I actually loved. They're like, you know what? Let's just scratch out Sokovia and call it the Tony Stark Accord, and we'll sign it right now.
Well, I think you're right that there was a lot of shorthand in the movie. Because
Not only were they blaming the Avengers for all these other things, but like, we want you to sign this now. Like, let's haggle, let's negotiate about this. It has to be done right now.
I do remember being overwhelmed by it. Now that I'm thinking more about my initial state, I think what I liked about it was that the fact that I felt like it's what I wanted out of Avengers 2. Mm. And I didn't much care. Avengers 2 was just sort of like, I felt it was too cluttered too. And this was, like, there was a lot of character moments. There's a bazillion characters, and they all fit. And I was really impressed intellectually by how they could juggle this ridiculous thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the plot itself is kind of, you know, paper thin in many places.
Yeah.
And it was really an excuse to... It's one of these things that, like, the airport scene when they all fight each other. It's really just an excuse for seeing your favorite guy beat up other guys.
Yeah.
And I can completely understand people who don't like that. On the other hand, it's also so much fun to watch. So I have this conflicted thing that on one hand, half the movie's just fan service, but on the other hand, I like it.
Yeah.
So it's one of those movies that I think for myself, I'll forgive because it is what it's trying to be, but I wouldn't, you know, it's not going to be one of those movies I'm going to buy and rewatch 10,000 times.
Right.
It's the product of 10 years of Marvel.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. It was just another one of those cases where I see the, you know, internet kind of inflates everything one way or the other.
No, that's true.
And I felt that it was kind of a B movie that a lot of people were treating as like A+. And like, this movie has a lot of problems. There's some really fun scenes in it. I totally will agree. There's a lot of fun scenes.
There's
in
like
it.
Corners cut plot wise.
Yeah, the other one that really bugged me, and maybe this is nitpicky, but it's like, okay, Captain America and who was with him at the time? Whoever was on that plane.
Oh, probably
I can't remember now.
Winter Soldier, man.
Oh yeah, Winter Soldier. That's right. Bucky. So they're on the plane, they had escaped the airport and all this stuff. Tony has time to take War Machine to get fixed up, visit the underwater prison, which somehow they brought all the other Avengers to and put in. Visit them, have this conversation, long conversation, and then go catch up with them like 10 minutes after they arrived the place that they had left for. It's like, wait, what?
No, I know. And the thing is, some of this stuff could be solved with like two sentences, you know, and they don't for what. And like, my thing is, okay, like the introducing Spider-Man scene, which is hilarious.
Yeah. Definitely.
But it's also 10, 15, you know, it's like 10 minutes.
It is kind of a detour.
That's not, if you were strictly doing from an editing movie point of view, you would not do.
Yeah.
It's the whole movie has this vibe of, we're doing it because it's lots of fun, but it doesn't necessarily, the choice you would make if you were being a strict editor, screenwriter sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's both the advantage and, or not the advantage, but what appeals to it about, to some people, and also what, you know, is a detractor from it. And I can really, I remember, I think, feeling both things when I watched it.
Right. As a side note to this, we won't go into much because it wasn't really a summer movie, but since we have talked about it, I thought I should mention Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice.
Oh yeah.
Which I felt was not as good as Civil War, but also not as bad as some people made it out. Like, it was definitely kind of a disappointment. I would say I didn't even like it as much as I enjoyed Man of Steel, and there were more things that bothered me about this one. There's a lot of cool stuff about it, though. As I suspected, Ben Affleck actually did really well as Batman. I thought he was a really cool Batman. Like, and a lot of the cast was pretty good, except for Jesse Eisenberg's weird take on Luther. I will totally agree with everyone's critiques on that. It was a really weird take. One part, and I know you haven't seen it,
yeah,
but
that's fine. Go ahead.
You don't care about spoilers.
No.
One part that the internet has just ridiculed to death was actually a part that I kind of liked. At the very end of this long fight, which, man, Batman is a jerk throughout most of this movie. Like, as I predicted, he was a total tool. So they go through this whole fight, and Superman, one thing I really appreciated is he's trying to hold back.
Yeah.
Like, he knows he wants to work. He's kind of forced into this scenario by Lex Luthor.
Yeah, the thematic idea of Superman being basically God, but trying not to be.
Yeah.
I thought was a neat ending to Man of Steel.
Uh-huh. And they carry that through. If I complain about how Superman is portrayed in this movie, I would still say he's holding back his enjoyment of being Superman a little too much.
Yeah.
And I blame that Zack Snyder on that more than anything. I mean, I enjoy some of Zack Snyder's style, but some interviews I've seen make me realize he really wasn't the best guy for this. But anyway, the part that I wanted to get to. So at the very end, basically, Batman's been beating Superman down. I mean, they both get in some really good hits.
Yeah.
It's a really fun fight overall. But at the very end, he kind of has him cornered, and Superman croaks out, "Save Martha," because his mother is Martha Kent has been hidden. And Batman kind of he's stunned by this, actually. He's kind of taken aback because his mother was named Martha, and obviously Batman's parents are a big deal.
Yeah.
And there's this sort of this moment of realization of, like, he's just a normal dude. I have been a jerk. And it was very satisfying to me. But people on the internet made fun of that all over the place. It's like, oh, both their moms have the same name. That's a stupid reason to stop fighting. And I'm like, I didn't take it that way. I took it as this, like, they're both humans. I mean, sure, one of them's from another planet, which happened to give him superpowers, but in the end, he's just a man.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing with superhero movies in current culture is that there's so much pre-expectation.
Yeah.
And so much nitpicky, and it's very hard to enjoy them and just what they're trying to be. And sometimes the movies themselves are self-aware.
Yeah.
Which causes problems as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, guys, calm down. It's just a movie. You really should relax.
Pretty much. And like I said, I will fully admit that Civil War is a better movie.
Yeah.
Is for the problems I had, I will admit that it is a better movie than Batman v Superman, but these things get taken way out
in the internet. The problem is probably Civil War gave people what they wanted anyways, and Batman v Superman gave them what they were expecting, which was not as much as they wanted.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, anyways.
All right,
10 Cloverfield Lane isn't a summer movie, is it?
What?
10 Cloverfield Lane.
No, I think that was spring.
Also good movie.
I keep meaning to see it, but I guess you could talk. I mean, Batman vs. Superman, and I just talked for a while about that, so you can mention if you want.
I'll mention real quick. We saw it on DVD, so I didn't figure it was, but I loved Cloverfield, the movie. We saw it in the theater. You and me saw it together, actually.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Man, that movie was a trip. Talk about, like, awe and, like, I've never seen something like this before.
Yeah.
I know some people hated it because it was, like, dumb talk in the beginning and then the steady cam, but it worked for me all the way.
Mm-hmm.
10 Cloverfield Lane is very different because there's no steady cam for one. And it's all
not steady cam, shaky cam.
That's two different things. A very different thing. But it's all basically like three people in a bunker for most of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you just feel uncomfortable. It's just kind of tense for like an hour. And it works really well. I won't mention much about the end, but I think the end is a thing that you would either like or dislike depending on what you're going for, or what your expectations are.
Okay.
But I really enjoyed the whole movie.
Interesting. I've been really, I think you would enjoy it
too. It was certainly worth watching, and John Goodman will never again be not creepy.
That's unfortunate because he's a very cheery guy normally.
Yes. And greatest scene of playing charades or what? No, Pictionary of charades. I don't know ever.
Okay.
Anyways. Okay.
All right.
Watch another movie here.
Next movie, Star Trek Beyond.
Yes. I wanted to see this movie.
Yes. Which I quite enjoyed going into it. I really had absolutely no expectations for it. I really wasn't even particularly excited for it. Because it's funny, I remember enjoying Into Darkness well enough when it was in the theater, but when I was thinking about it after, I don't really remember much of it.
Yeah.
Like certain things, but it was not a movie that stuck with me, at least not even as much as 2009 one did. But this one I thought was really funny. It felt like they actually stay at the beginning. They're 3 years into their 5-year mission.
Okay.
So, which is cool to not be a prequel, that they're kind of into their own continuity finally,
which is nice, because in Darkness was playing, depending on who you talked to, too much on
Earth,
Well, and on old themes.
Oh,
you're still rehashing.
Yeah,
you're almost living in the glory of the old Star Trek, and you just at some point you gotta go and be your own thing.
Yeah, and I think they did some of that. I mean, they'll be. You could argue that there's still some of the same themes they touched on in this one, but at the same time, you also felt like they were exploring. They were trying to do their own things in some ways, and I don't. And it felt like in some ways, some people have compared it to an episode of a TV show, and it was kind of like that. I don't know that I have a whole lot to say about it. Although I remember I talked about this with Greg one night, and we both sort of agreed that there's a moment toward the end where the movie could have ended. And then they go on a little farther and they add a new twist to things.
Should it have ended?
Maybe. Greg felt like it should have. I heard someone else online made a good case for really enjoying what they did with the twist and the depth they gave to a particular character.
Okay.
So I could take it either way. I mean, I definitely felt that like after the certain bit, I was like, oh, we're still going? Well, okay. And they did some interesting things. It's just they could have ended it a little bit and would have been, you know, just a different take.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun to talk about it after you've seen it. I'm not going to touch it right now because I know you will eventually.
Yeah.
So the last one I will touch on is Finding Dory.
Finding Dory. I did, would have seen it in a normal world.
It's a shame in some ways that it was rated PG. Like,
and they might call it a busy time. Summer being so short now with the kids, there's so much other things.
Oh, maybe
trying to get done.
I didn't know that it had anything to do with it or not. I mean, it's a G movie, honestly. Yeah. Like,
did they just rate for that for getting people to come, or you know, sometimes they?
I honestly don't know.
Is it scary? I mean, sometimes if it's slightly scary,
maybe that's why. But I don't know. I've seen other G-rated movies I thought would be more intense. Yeah. Like,
there smoking? That'll make it PG-13.
I don't remember smoking. I think it might be for thematic elements.
Okay.
Because I do remember, like, they set up in the beginning, they set up Dory, they do a lot of flashbacks to Dory as a kid with her family. But they set the way they set it up at the beginning where she gets separated from them and, you know, a kid separated from her parents. And it is really heartrending.
That's probably one reason we didn't necessarily take, because Fio doesn't, you know.
Oh, yeah.
We always like to watch some of these because you just don't know emotionally what some of them are going to be like.
Okay, that's a good point. I mean,
because when we showed him Up, he got kind of sad at how he's always talking to his wife that's not there.
Oh, sure.
So
yeah, okay. And maybe that is because, I mean, you do get the sense of it gives you a different perspective on Dory's amnesia. You know, before it's mostly played for
humor.
But it gives you kind of this like sense of what would it be like to be completely lost to, and having been so lost that you can't even remember your parents, your family.
Yeah.
But it pays off in the end, I felt. For me, it was a very moving movie, in some ways more than Finding Nemo was for me.
Well, that's what I was going to ask is, you know, I'm always suspicious when people make sequels. Mm-hmm. Is it a sequel worth making?
I think it is. Now, and when I say it moved me a bit more than Nemo, I don't know how much of that is the movie and how much of it is me, in a sense. Because I remember when Finding Nemo came out, I didn't have quite as strong a reaction to it as other people did. Maybe partly because, you know, I was college age. Yeah. If the story felt more traditional, in a sense, even though the underwater stuff was cool and all that, you know, after the insanity of Monsters, Inc., where, like, I mean, that's a crazy concept. This kind of father-son thing felt much more mundane, in a sense. And I don't know, like I said, the whole Dory's dilemma just got to me this time, maybe because I'm older and sappier or something.
Yeah, it happens.
One particular thing that's quite different this time, and this is much less of a journey movie as Finding Nemo was, because like they hop a ride with the turtles, basically, and they get to California pretty quickly in terms of movie time.
Yeah.
So it's less about that and more about, you also get a sense of fish are very fragile characters, in a sense. They have to do up, the filmmakers do a lot of creative ways of moving the fish around and outside of the ocean. Like, they have this octopus that the movie would just not be possible without this octopus that literally carries Dory from place to place. And he's a fun character. Some might think that's a critique against the movie, but I enjoyed it. And when I say they really pushed the limits of what you can do with fish, like, they actually had like this car chase at the end with the octopus like doing the pedals and Dory giving directions. Like, okay, I'm not really buying this, but I know this got pitched in a meeting sometimes and you all thought it was hilarious. And It kind of is.
I did hear that it was a little zanier than Nemo.
It is. It is in some ways.
Now, the perennial question people ask: where does this fit on the Pixar chart? I mean, like, just not exactly, but you know, is it like the great, the goods, or the whatever one you don't like?
I'd say it's on the higher level of the goods.
Okay,
on that scale. Yeah. WALL-E, The Incredibles, Inside Out. Toy Stories, those are kind of what I would call the pinnacles.
Yeah.
Even Monsters, Inc. a little bit. But yeah, I personally would place this a little above Finding Nemo.
Okay.
That's just personally. Other people may have different reactions.
Pixar, yeah, everyone's going to have a different order.
Yeah. All right, we need to wrap this up.
Okay. Well, I don't have any more movies, so.
Yeah.
All right, there's our take on Tails, everyone.
If you'd like to listen to past episodes where we do takes on last year's movies or previous summer movies, you can find those at derailedtrainsofthought.blogspot.com.
Subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher, wherever fine podcasts are.
And I'm going to update the YouTube. I started working on that, and then Revelation just kind of swamped me, the dance thing. So they will be updating, hopefully, before too long.
And leave us comments, give us suggestions for, topics, for things we really need to watch.
And leave us reviews on iTunes.
Yes.
All that stuff helps.
So yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed this. And Tim, I don't really want to leave here because it's just about perfect. But how about we'll just chill and you give us some soundtrack to leave on.
Okay. Well, it's not really a chill song, but, and I don't know if I can compare to Beethoven, but.
What can?
Yeah. Pretty much. But this is from the
Mahler.
No, we're going back to OC Remix for this. This is from their album Worlds Apart, the Final Fantasy IX album. The remixers are Chris Wu, that's his real name. I'm not gonna try to pronounce his screen name, and Fishy. And the song the remix is called To Be Forgotten. And this actually goes more into the tragic side of transcendental music. Yeah. It's a long song, but hey, Nick got Glowworm Jim last time.
Yes, so. Glowworm Jim.
So this is 6 minutes as opposed to seven, but I think it's just a beautiful journey. The song in the game is actually like the characters are doing a dance, sort of reaffirming their culture moments before their culture gets destroyed. So this song is, I think, a beautiful kind of rendition of that, kind of struggling through hope in the midst of darkness.
Sounds awesome.
So I hope you enjoy it.
All right.
Until next time, thank you for listening.
This has been Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye.